When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Some Terms of Thought in Modern Philosophy, Essay Number 4, A Long Way Round to Nirvana. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Some Terms of Thought in Modern Philosophy, 5 Essays by George Santayana. Essay Number 4, A Long Way Round to Nirvana. Development of a Suggestion Found in Freud's Beyond the Pleasure Principle. That the end of life is death may be called a truism, since the various kinds of immortality that might perhaps supervene would none of them abolish death, but at best would weave life and death together into the texture of a more comprehensive density. The end of one life might be the beginning of another. If the Creator had composed his great work like a dramatic poet, assigning successive lines to different characters, death would then be merely the cue at the end of each speech, summoning the next personage to break in and keep the ball rolling. Or perhaps, as some suppose, all the characters are assumed in turn by a single supernatural spirit, who amid his endless improvisations is imagining himself living for the moment in this particular solar and social system. Death in such a universal monologue would be but a change of scene or of meter, while in the scramble of a real comedy it would be a change of actors. In either case, every voice would be silenced sooner or later, and death would end each particular life in spite of all possible sequels. The relapse of created things into nothing is no violent fatality, but something naturally quite smooth and proper. This has been set forth recently, in a novel way, by a philosopher from whom we hardly expected such a lesson, namely Professor Sigmund Freud. He has now broadened his conception of sexual craving, or libido, into a general principle of attraction, or concretion in matter. Like the Eros of the ancient poets Hesiod and Empedocles, the windows of that stuffy clinic have been thrown open. That smell of acrid disinfectants, those hysterical shrieks, have escaped into the cold night. The troubles of the sick soul, we are given to understand, as well as their cure, after all, flow from the stars. I am glad that Freud has resisted the tendency to represent this principle of love as the only principle in nature. Unity somehow exercises an evil spell over metaphysicians. It is admitted that in real life it is not well for one to be alone, and I think pure unity is no less barren and graceless in metaphysics. You must have plurality to start with, or trinity, or at least duality, if you wish to get anywhere, even if you wish to get effectively into the bosom of the One, abandoning your separate existence. Freud, like Empedocles, has prudently introduced a prior principle for love to play with, not strife, however, which is only an incident in love, but inertia, or the tendency towards peace and death. Let us suppose that matter was originally dead, and perfectly content to be so, and that it still relapses, when it can, into its old equilibrium. But the homogeneous, as Spencer would say, when it is finite, is unstable, and matter, presumably not being coextensive with space, necessarily forms aggregates which have an inside and an outside. The parts of such bodies are accordingly differently exposed to external influences and are differently related to one another. This inequality, even in what seems most quiescent, is big with changes, destined to produce in time a wonderful complexity. It is the source of all uneasiness of life and love. Quote, "Let us imagine," writes Freud, "in an undifferentiated vesicle of sensitive substance, then its surface, exposed as it is to the outer world, is by its very position differentiated, and serves as an organ for receiving stimuli. This morsel of living substance floats about in an outer world which is charged with the most potent energies, and it would be destroyed if it were not furnished with protection against stimulation. On the other hand, the sensitive cortical layer has no protective barrier against excitations emanating from within. The most prolific sources of such excitations are the so-called instincts of the organism. The child never gets tired of demanding the repetition of a game. He always wants to hear the same story instead of a new one, insists inexorably on exact repetition, and corrects each deviation which the narrator lets slip by mistake. According to this, an instinct would be a tendency in a living organic matter, impelling it towards reinstatement of an earlier condition, one which it had abandoned under the influence of external disturbing forces, a kind of organic elasticity, or, to put it another way, the manifestation of inertia in organic life. If, then, all organic instincts are conservative, historically acquired, and directed toward regression, towards reinstatement of something earlier, we are obliged to place all the results of organic development to the credit of external, disturbing, and distracting influences. The rudimentary creature, from which its very beginning not have wanted to change, would, if circumstances had remained the same, have always merely repeated the same course of existence. It would be counter to the conservative nature of instinct if the goal of life were a state never hitherto reached. It must be rather an ancient starting point, which the living being left long ago, and to which it harks back again by all the circuitous paths of the development. The goal of life is death. Through a long period of time, the living substance may have had death within easy reach, until decisive external influences altered in such a way as to compel it to ever greater deviations from the original path, and to ever more complicated and circuitous routes to the attainment of the goal of death. These circuitous ways of death, faithfully retained by the conservative instincts, would be neither more nor less than the phenomena of life as we know it. End quote. Freud puts forth these interesting suggestions with much modesty, admitting that they are vague and uncertain and, what is even more important to notice, mythical in their terms. But it seems to me that, for all that, they are admirable counterblast to prevalent follies. When we hear that there is, animating the whole universe, an élan vital, or general impulse, toward some unknown but single ideal, the terms used are no less uncertain, mythical, and vague. But the suggestion conveyed is false. False, I mean, to the organic source of life and aspiration, to the simple naturalness of nature. Whereas the suggestion conveyed by Freud's speculation is true. In what sense can myths and metaphors be true or false? In what sense that, in terms drawn from moral predicaments or from literary psychology, they may report the general movement and the permanent issue of material facts, and may inspire us with a wise sentiment in their presence? In this sense, I should say that Greek mythology was true and Calvinist theology was false. The chief terms employed by a psychoanalyst have always been metaphorical: unconscious wishes, the pleasure principle, the Oedipus complex, narcissism, the censor. Nevertheless, interesting and profound vistas may be opened up in such terms to the tangle of events in a man's life, and a fresh start may be made with fewer encumbrances and less morbid inhibition. The shortcomings of our description, Freud said, would probably disappear if for psychological terms we could substitute physiological or chemical ones. These too only constitute a metaphorical language, but one familiar to us for a much longer time and perhaps also much simpler. All human discourse is metaphorical, in that our perceptions and thoughts are adventitious signs for their objects, as names are, and by no means copies of what is going on materially in the depths of nature, but just as the sportsman's eye, which yields but a summary graphic image, can trace the flight of a bird through the air quite well enough to shoot it and bring it down, so the myths of a wise philosopher about the origin of life, or of dreams, though expressed symbolically, may reveal the permanent movement of nature to us, and may kindle in us just sentiments and true expectations in respect to our fate. For his own soul is the bird this sportsman is shooting. Now I think these new myths of Freud's about life, like his old ones about dreams, are calculated to enlighten and to chasten us enormously about ourselves. The human spirit, when it awakes, finds itself in trouble. It is burdened for no reason it can assign with all sorts of anxieties about food, pressures, pricks, noises, and pains. It is born, as another wise myth has it, in original sin, and the passions and ambitions of life, as they come on, only complicate this burden and make it heavier, without rendering it less incessant or gratuitous. Whence this fatality, or whither does it lead? It comes from heredity, and it leads to propagation. When we ask how heredity could be started or transmitted, our ignorance of nature and of past times reduces us to silence or to wild conjectures. Something, let us call it matter, must always have existed, and some of its parts, under pressure of the others, must have got tied up into knots, like the mainspring of a watch, in such a violent and unhappy manner that when the pressure is released they fly open as fast as they can, and unravel themselves with a vast sense of relief. Hence the longings to satisfy latent passions with the fugitive pleasure in doing so. But the external agencies that originally wound up that mainspring never cease to operate. Every fresh stimulus gives it another turn, until it snaps, or grows flaccid, or is unhinged. Moreover, from time to time, when circumstances change, these external agencies may encrust that primary organ with minor organs attached to it. Every impression, every adventure, leaves a trace, or rather a seed, behind it. It produces a further complication in the structure of the body, and a fresh charge which tends to repeat the impressed motion in season and out of season. Hence, that perpetual docility or ductility in living substance which enables it to learn tricks and to remember facts, and, when the seeds of past experience marry and cross in the brain, to imagine new experiences, pleasing or horrible. Every act initiates a new habit and may implant a new instinct. We see people, even late in life, carried away by political or religious contagions, or developing strange vices. There would be no peace in old age, but rather a greater and greater obsession of all sorts of cares, were it not that time, in exposing us to many adventurous influences, weakens or discharges our primitive passions. We are less greedy, less lusty, less hopeful, less generous. But these weakened primitive impulses are naturally by far the strongest and most deeply rooted in the organism, so that, although an old man may be converted or may take up some hobby, there is usually something thin in his elderly zeal compared with the heartiness of youth, nor is it edifying to see a soul in which the plainer human passions are extinct becoming a hotbed of chance delusions. In any case, fresh habit taking root in the organism forms a little mainspring or instinct of its own, like a parasite, so that an elaborate mechanism is gradually developed where each lever and spring holds the other down, and all hold the mainspring down together, allowing it to unwind itself only very gradually, and meantime keeping the whole clock ticking and revolving and causing the smooth outer face which it turns to the world, so clean and innocent, to mark the time of day amiably for the passer-by. But there is a terrible complicated labor going on beneath, propelled with difficulty and balanced precariously with much secret friction and failure. No wonder that the engine often gets visibly out of order or stops short. The marvel is that it ever manages to go at all. Nor is it satisfied with simply revolving, and when at last dismounted, starting afresh in the person of some seed it has dropped, a portion of its substance with all its concentrated instincts wound up tightly within it and eager to repeat the ancestral experiment. All this growth is not merely material and vain. Each clock in revolving strikes the hour, even the quarters, and often with lovely chimes. These chimes we call perceptions, feelings, purposes, and dreams. And it is because we are taken up entirely with this mental music, and perhaps think that it sounds of itself and needs no music box to make it, that we find such difficulty in conceiving nature of our own clocks, and are compelled to describe them only musically, that is, in myths. But the ineptitude of our aesthetic minds to unravel the nature of mechanism does not deprive these minds of their own clearness and euphony. Besides sounding their various musical notes, they have the cognitive function of indicating the hour and catching the echoes of distant events or of maturing inward dispositions. This information and emotion, added to incidental pleasures in satisfying our various passions, make up the life of an incarnate spirit. They reconcile it to the external fatality that has wound up the organism and is breaking it down, and they rescue this organism and all its works from the indignity of being a vain complication and a waste of motion. That the end of life should be death may sound sad, yet what other end can anything have? The end of an evening party is to go to bed, but its use is to gather congenial people together that they may pass the time pleasantly. An invitation to the dance is not rendered ironical because the dance cannot last forever. The youngest of us, and the most vigorously wound up, after a few hours has had enough of sinuous stepping and prancing. The transitoriness of things is essential to their physical being, and not at all sad in itself. It becomes sad by virtue of a sentimental illusion which makes us imagine that they wish to endure, and that their end is always untimely. But in a healthy nature, it is not so. What is truly sad is to have some impulse frustrated in the midst of its career, and robbed of its chosen object, and what is painful is to have an organ lacerated or destroyed when it is still vigorous, and not ready for its natural sleep and dissolution. We must not confuse the itch which our unsatisfied instincts continue to cause with the pleasure of satisfying and dismissing each of them in turn. Could they all be satisfied harmoniously, we should be satisfied once for all and completely. Then, doing and dying would coincide throughout and be a perfect pleasure. The same insight is contained in another wise myth which has inspired morality and religion in India from time immemorial. I mean the doctrine of karma. We are born, it says, with a heritage, a character imposed and a long task assigned, all due to the ignorance which in our past lives has led us into all sorts of commitments. These obligations we must pay off, relieving the pure spirit within us from its accumulated burdens, from debts and assets both equally oppressive. We cannot disentangle ourselves by mere frivolity, nor by suicide. Frivolity would only involve us more deeply in the toils of fate, and suicide would but truncate our misery and leave us forever a confused failure. When life is understood to be a process of redemption, its various phases are taken up in turn without haste and without undue attachment. Their coming and going have all the keenness of pleasure, the holiness of sacrifice, and the beauty of art. The point is to have expressed and discharged all that was latent in us, and to this perfect relief, various temperaments and various traditions assign different names, calling it having one's day, or doing one's duty, or realizing one's ideal, or saving one's soul. The task, in any case, is defined and imposed on us by nature, whether we recognize it or not. Therefore, we can take true moral progress or fall into real errors. Wisdom and genius lie in discharging this prescribed task and in doing it readily, cleanly, and without distraction. Folly, on the contrary, imagines that any scent is worth following, that we have an infinite nature or no nature in particular, and that life begins without obligations and can do business without capital, and that the will is vacuitously free, instead of being a specific burden and a tight hereditary knot to be unraveled. Some philosophers, without self-knowledge, think that the variations and further entanglements which the future may bring are the manifestation of spirit, but they are, as Freud has indicated, imposed on living beings by external pressure and take shape in the realm of matter. It is only after the organs of spirit are formed mechanically that spirit can exist and can distinguish the better from the worse in the fate of those organs, and therefore in its own fate. Spirit has nothing to do with infinite existence. Infinite existence is something physical and ambiguous. There is no scale in it and no center. The depths of the human heart are finite, and they are dark only to ignorance. Deep and dark as a soul may be when you look down into it from outside, it is something perfectly natural, and the same understanding that can unearth our suppressed young passions and dispel our stubborn bad habits can show us where our true good lies. Nature has marked out the path for us beforehand. There are snares in it, but also primroses, and it leads to peace. End of essay number 4. Some Terms of Thought in Modern Philosophy. Essay number 5, The Prestige of the Infinite. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Some Terms of Thought in Modern Philosophy. 5 Essays by George Santayana. Essay number 5, The Prestige of the Infinite. A review of Julian Brenda's Sketch of a Consistent Theory of the Relations Between God and the World. The more complex the world becomes, and the more it rises above the intermediate, so much the further removed it is from God. That is to say, so much the more impious it is. Monsieur Julian Brenda is not led to this startling utterance by any political or sentimental grudge. It is not the late war, nor the peace of Versailles, nor the perilous state of the arts, nor the decay of morality and prosperity that disgusts him with our confused world. It is simply overmastering respect for the infinite, la trahison des clercs, or treason of the Levites, with which he had previously upbraided the intellectuals of his time, now appears to consist precisely in coveting a part in this world's inheritance, and forgetting that the inheritance of the Levites is the Lord, which, being interpreted philosophically, means that a philosopher is bound to measure all things by the infinite. This infinite is not rhetorical, as if we spoke of infinite thought or infinite love. It is physio-mathematical. Nothing but number, Monsieur Benda tells us, seems to him intelligible. Time, space, volume, and complexity, which appears to the senses as quality, stretch in a series of units, positions, or degrees to infinity, as number does, and in such homogeneous series, infinite in both directions, there will be no fixed point of origin for counting or surveying the whole, and no particular predominant scale. Every position will be essentially identical with every other. Every suggested structure will be collapsible and reversible, and the position and relations of every unit will be indistinguishable from those of every other. In the infinite, Monsieur Benda says, the parts have no identity. Each number in the scale, as we begin counting from different points of origin, bears also every other number. This is no mere mathematical puzzle. The thought has a strange moral eloquence. Seen in their infinite setting, which we may presume to be their ultimate environment, all things lose their central position and their dominance. The contrary of what we first think of them or of ourselves, for instance, that we are alive while they are dead or unborn, is also true. Egotism becomes absurd. Pride and shame become the vainest of illusions. If then it be repugnant to reason that the series of numbers, moments, positions, and volumes should be limited, and the human spirit has a great affinity to the infinite, all specific quality and variety in things must be superficial and deeply unreal. They are masks in the carnival of phenomena, to be observed without conviction, and secretly dismissed as ironical by those who have laid up their treasure in the infinite. The mathematical disillusion of particulars is reinforced by moral considerations which are more familiar. Existence, any specific fact asserting itself in any particular place or moment, is inevitably contingent, arbitrary, gratuitous, and insecure. A sense of insecurity is likely to be the first wedge by which repentance penetrates into the animal heart. If a man did not foresee death and fear it, he might never come at all to the unnatural thought of renouncing life. In fact, he does not often remember death, yet his whole gay world is secretly afraid of being found out, of being foiled in the systematic bluff by which it lives as if its life were immortal. And far more than the brave young man fears death in his own person, the whole life of the world fears to be exercised by self-knowledge and lost in air. And with good reason, because, whether we stop to notice this circumstance or not, every fact, every laborious, beloved achievement of man or of nature, has come to exist against infinite odds, in the dark grab bag of being. This chosen fact was surrounded by innumerable possible variations or contradictions of it, and each of these possibilities, happening not to be realized here and now, yet possesses intrinsically exactly the same aptitude or claim to existence. Nor are these claims and aptitudes merely imaginary and practically contemptible. The flux of existence is continually repenting of its choices and giving everything actual the lie, by continually substituting something else, no less specific and no less nugatory. This world, any world, exists only by an unmerited privilege. Its glory is offensive to the spirit, like the self-sufficiency of some obstreperous nobody who happens to have drawn the big prize in a lottery. The world, Monsieur Benda writes, inspires me with a double sentiment. I feel it to be full of grandeur because it has succeeded in asserting itself and coming to exist, and I feel it to be pitiful when I consider how it hung on a mere nothing that this particular world should never have existed. And though this so accidental world, by its manifold beauties and excitements, may arouse our romantic enthusiasm, it is fundamentally an unholy world. Its creation, he adds in italics, is something which reason should wish had never taken place. For we must not suppose that God, when God is defined as infinite being, can be the creator of the world. Such a notion would hopelessly destroy that coherence in thought to which M. Benda aspires. The infinite cannot be selective, it cannot possess a particular structure, such, for instance, as the Trinity, nor a particular quality, such as goodness. It cannot exert power or give direction. Nothing can be responsible for the world except the world itself. It has created, or is creating, itself perpetually by its own arbitrary act, by a groundless self-assertion which may be called, somewhat metaphorically, will, or even original sin. The original sin of existence, particularly selfishness or separation from God. Existence, being absolutely contingent and ungrounded, is perfectly free, and if it ties itself up in its own habits or laws and becomes a terrible nightmare to itself by its automatic monotony, that still is only its own work and, figuratively speaking, its own fault. Nothing save its own arbitrary and needless pressure keeps it going in that round. This fatality is impressive, and popular religion has symbolized it in the person of a deity far more often recognized and worshipped than infinite being. This popular deity, a symbol for the forces of nature and history, the patron of the human welfare and morality, M. Benda calls the imperial god. It is clear that these two gods have nothing to do with one another. The god whom Marshal de Villers, rising in his stirrups and pointing his drawn sword heavenward, thanks on the evening of Denain, is one god. Quite another is the god within, whose bosom the author of the Imitation, in a corner of his cell, feels the nothingness of human victories. It follows from this, if we are coherent, that any return to God which ascetic philosophy may bring about cannot be a social reform, a transition to some better form of natural existence in a promised land, a renovated earth, or a material or temporal heaven. Nor can the error of creation be corrected violently by a second arbitrary act, such as suicide or the annihilation of the universe by some ultimate general collapse. If such events happen, they will leave the door open to new creations and fresh errors. But the marvel is, I will return to this point presently, that the world, in the person of a human individual endowed with reason, may perceive the error of its ways and correct it ideally. In the sphere of estimation and worship, such is the only possible salvation. Reason, in order to save us, and we, in order to be saved, must both subsist. We must both be incidents in the existing world. We may then, by the operation of reason in us, recover our allegiance to the infinite, for we are bone of its bone and flesh of its flesh, and by our secret sympathy with it, we may rescind every peculiar claim and dismiss silently every peculiar form of being as something unreal and unholy. It is incapable of love, wrath, or any other passion. I will add, writes M. Benda, something else which theories of an impersonal deity have less often pointed out. Such infinity is incompatible with personal being. God is capable of morality. Thus, mere intuition and analysis of the infinite, since this infinite is itself passive and indifferent, may prove a subtle antidote to passion, to folly, and even to life. I think M. Benda succeeds admirably in the purpose announced in his title of rendering his discourse coherent. If once we accept his definitions, his corollaries follow. Clearly and bravely, he disengages his idea of infinity from other properties usually assigned to the deity, such as power, omniscience, goodness, and tutelary functions in respect to life, or to some special human society. But coherence is not completeness, nor even a reasonable measure of descriptive truth, and certain considerations are omitted from M. Benda's view, which are of moment that, if they were included, they might transform the whole issue. Perhaps the chief of these omissions is that of an organ of thought. M. Benda, throughout, is engaged simply in clarifying his own ideas and repeatedly disclaims any ulterior pretensions. He finds in the panorama of his thoughts an idea of infinite being or God, and proceeds to study the relation of that conception to all others. It is a task of critical analysis and religious confession, and nothing could be more legitimate and, to some of us, more interesting. But whence these various ideas, and whence the spell which the ideas of infinite being in particular casts over the meditative mind? Unless we can view these moments of thought in their natural setting and order of genesis, we shall be in danger of turning autobiography into cosmology and inwardness into folly. One of the most notable points in Monsieur Benda's analysis is his insistence on the leap involved in passing from infinite being to any particular fact or system of facts, and again the leap involved in passing when the converted spirit returns to God. From specific animal interests, no matter how generous, social, or altruistic these interests may be, to absolute reincarnation and sympathy with the absolute. That a will to return to God should arise in the phenomenal world seems to be a miracle of no less wonderful, though it may be less wondered at, than that the world should arise in the bosom of God. Love of man, charity, humanitarianism are nothing but the selfishness of the race by which each animal species asserts its specific existence. To surrender one's individuality for the benefit of a larger self is something quite different from disinterestedness. It is the exact opposite. And certainly, if we regard infinite being as a cosmological medium, say, empty space and time, there would be a miraculous break, an unaccountable new beginning, if that glassy expanse was suddenly wrinkled by something called energy. But in fact, there need never have been such a leap or such a miracle, because there could never have been such a transition. Infinite being is not a material vacuum in the bosom of which a world might arise. It is a Platonic idea, though Plato never entertained it, an essence, non-existent and immutable, not in the same field of reality at all as a world of moving and colliding things. Such an essence is not conceivably the seat of the variations that enliven the world. It is only in thought that we may pass from infinite being to an existing universe. And when we turn from one to the other and say that now energy has emerged from the bosom of God, we are turning over a new leaf, or rather picking up an entirely different volume. The natural world is composed of objects and events which theory may regard as transformations of a hypothetical energy, an energy which Monsieur Benda, who when he comes down to the physical world is a good materialist, conceives to have condensed and distributed itself into matter, which in turn composed organisms and ultimately generated consciousness and reason. But in whatever manner the natural world may have evolved, it is found and positioned by us in perception and action, not like infinite being defined in thought. This contrast is ontological and excludes any derivation of the one object from the other. Monsieur Benda himself tells us so, and we may wonder why he introduced infinite being at all into his description of the world. The reason, doubtless, is that he was not engaged in describing the world except by the way, but rather in classifying and clarifying his ideas in view of determining his moral allegiance. And he arranged his terms, whether ideal or materials, in a single series because they were alike present to his intuition, and he was concerned to arrange them in a hierarchy according to their moral dignity. Not only is infinite being an incongruous and obstructive term to describe the substance of the world, which, if it subtends the changes in the world and causes them, must evidently change with them, but even mathematical space and time in their ideal infinity may be very far from describing truly the medium and groundwork of the universe. That is a question for investigation and hypothesis, not for intuition. But in the life of intuition, when that life takes a mathematical turn, empty space and time and their definable structure may be important themes, while when the same life becomes a discipline of the affections, we see by this latest example as well as by many a renowned predecessor of M. Benda's, that infinite being may dominate the scene. Nor is this eventual dominance so foreign to the natural mind, or such a miraculous conversion as it might seem. Here, too, there is no derivation of object from object, but an alternative for the mind. As M. Benda points out, natural interests and sympathies may expand indefinitely, so as to embrace a family, a nation, or the whole animate universe. We might even be chiefly occupied with liberal pursuits, such as science or music. The more we labored at these things and delighted in them, the less ready should we be for renunciation and detachment. Must conversion then descend upon us from heaven like a thunderbolt? Far from it. We need not look for the principle of spiritual life in the distance. We have it at home from the beginning. Even the idea of infinite being, though unnamed, is probably familiar. Perhaps in the biography of the human race, or of each budding mind, the infinite or indeterminate may have been the primary datum. On the homogeneous, sensuous background, blank at first, but secretly plastic, a spot here and a movement there may gradually have become discernible, until the whole picture of nature and history had shaped itself as we see it. A certain sense of that primitive datum, the infinite or indeterminate, may always remain, as it were, the outstretched canvas on which every picture is painted. And when the pictures vanish, as in deep sleep, the ancient simplicity and quietness may be actually recovered in a conscious union with Brahman. So sensuous, so intimate, so unsophisticated, the return to God may be for the spirit, without excluding the other avenues, intellectual and aesthetic, by which this return may be effected in waking life, though then not so much an act as an intent only and allegiance. I confess that formerly I had some difficulty in sharing the supreme respect for infinite being which animates so many saints. It seems to me the dazed, the empty, the deluded side of spirituality. Why rest in an object which can be redeemed from blank negation only by a blank intensity? But time has taught me not to despise any form of vital imagination. Any discipline which may achieve perfection after any kind of intuition is a broadly based activity. It engages elaborate organs and sums up and synthesizes accumulated impressions. It may therefore easily pour the riches of its ancestry into the image or the sentiment which it evokes, poor as this sentiment or image might seem if expressed in words. In rapt or ecstatic moments, the vital momentum, often the moral escape, is everything, and the achievement, apart from the blessed relief, little or nothing. Infinite being may profit in this way by offering a contrast to infinite annoyance. Moreover, in my own way, I have discerned in a pure being the involution of all forms. As felt, pure being may be indeterminate, but as conceived reflectively, it includes all determinations, so that when deployed into the realm of essence, infinite and indeterminate being truly contains entertainment for all eternity. M. Benda feels this pregnancy of the infinite on the mathematical side, but he hardly notices the fact, proclaimed so gloriously by Spinoza, that the infinity of extension is only one of an infinity of infinities. There is an aesthetic infinite, or many aesthetic infinites, composed of all the forms which nature or imagination might exhibit, and where imagination fails, there are infinite reminders of the unimagined. The version which M. Benda gives us of infinite being, limited to the mathematical dimension, is therefore unnecessarily cold and stark. His one infinity is monochrome, whereas the total infinity of essence, in which an infinity of outlines is only one item, is infinitely many-colored. Phenomena, therefore, fall in their essential variety within and not without infinite being, so that in returning to God, we might take the whole world with us, not indeed in its blind movement and piecemeal illumination as events occur, but in the after-image and panoramic portrait, as events are gathered together in the realm of truth. On the whole, I think M. Benda's two gods are less unfriendly to one another than his aggrieved tone might suggest. This pregnant little book ends on a tragic note. Hitherto, human self-assertion in the state of the family, while serving the imperial god, has paid some grudging honors, at least verbally, to the infinite god as well, under the guise of liberalism, love of mankind, or the negation of classes. But today this imperfect homage is retracted, and nothing is reverenced except that which gives strength. If anyone preaches human kindness, it is in order to establish a strong community, martially trained, like a superstate, to oppose everything not included within it, and to become omnipotent in the art of utilizing the non-human forces of nature. The will to return to God may prove to have been, in the history of the phenomenal world, a sublime accident. Certainly, the will to return to God, if not an accident, is an incident in the life of the world, and the world itself is a sublime accident in the sense that its existence is contingent, groundless, and precarious. Yet so long as the imperial God continues successfully to keep our world going, it will be no accident, but a natural necessity, that many a mind should turn to the thought of the infinite with awe, with a sense of liberation, and even with joy. The infinite God owes all his worshippers, little as he may care for them, to the success of the imperial God in creating reflective and speculative minds, or, to drop these mythological expressions which may become tiresome, philosophers owe to nature and to the discipline of moral life their capacity to look beyond nature and beyond morality. And while they may look beyond and take comfort in the vision, they cannot pass beyond. As M. Benda says, the most faithful Levite can return to the infinite only in his thought, in his life he must remain a lay creature. Yet nature, in forming the human soul, unintentionally unlocked for the mind the doors to truth and to essence, partly by obliging the soul to attend to things which are outside, and partly by endowing the soul with far greater potentialities of sensation and invention than daily life is likely to call forth. Our minds are therefore naturally dissatisfied with their lot, and speculatively directed upon an outspread universe in which our persons count for almost nothing. These insights are calculated to give our brutal wills some pause. Intuition of the infinite and recourse to the infinite for religious inspiration follow of themselves and can never be suppressed altogether, so long as life is conscious and experience provokes reflection. Spirit is certainly not one of the forces producing spirit, but neither is it a contrary force. It is the actuality of feeling, of observation, of meaning. Spirit has no unmannerly quarrel with its parents, its hosts, or even its jailers. They know not what they do. Yet spirit belongs intrinsically to another sphere, and cannot help wondering at the world, and suffering in it. The man in whom spirit is awake will continue to live and act, but with a difference. Insofar as he has become pure spirit, he will have transcended the fear of death or defeat, and now his instinctive fear, which will subsist, will be neutralized by an equally sincere consent to die and to fail. He will live henceforth in a truer and more serene sympathy with nature than is possible to rival natural beings. Natural beings are perpetually struggling to live only, and not to die, so that their will is hopelessly rebellion against the divine decrees which they must obey notwithstanding. The spiritual man, on the contrary, in so far as he has already passed intellectually into the eternal world, no longer endures unwillingly the continual death involved in living, or the final death involved in having been born. He renounces everything religiously in the very act of attaining it, resigning existence itself as gladly as he accepts it, or even more gladly, because the emphasis which action and passion lend to the passing moment seem to him arbitrary and violent, and as each task or experience is dismissed in turn, he accounts the end of it more blessed than the beginning. End of essay number 5. End of Some Turns of Thought in Modern Philosophy by George Santayana.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.